Their power is when they are viewed as objective. They're the furthest thing from objective. They are not mainstream. They are radical. They're trying to destroy the country. They're pushing really bad, dangerous ideas. Treat them that way.
Molly Hemingway speaking on the state of American journalism at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
And yes, it would be nice if we had people aiming toward objectivity. We don't have that, so we just need to deal with reality.
Molly and I have a friend who's a bit of a, I don't know how you would describe Michael Malice. He has this great quote. He says, "The battle will be won when Americans regard journalists exactly the same way they regard tobacco executives."
You can watch a Q&A with journalists Mark and Molly Hemingway and the rest of the 2021 Making the Case conference. We'll send you a link to an on-demand video stream for a tax-deductible contribution of $300. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. By now, you have probably seen a number of these viral videos. They are parents standing at a podium, sometimes very angry, addressing the local school board, talking about critical race theory. And it's encouraging to see that parents have caught on to the fact that racism is being fed to our children in public schools under the guise of critical race theory that claims to be anti-racist but actually teaches our children to embrace racism in many different forms. That's encouraging. Is that enough? What else can parents do? Or is the system rigged? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to be talking about opposing critical race theory in our schools. Joy Pullman joins us. She's managing editor of The Federalist and author of the book, The Education Invasion. Joy, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. Thank you.
You say that the traditional political system is rigged against parents who want critical race theory out of their schools. What do you mean?
Well, I simply mean that the kind of American government that we're taught about, if we're lucky enough to have had a real basic American government class, you know, with the three branches of government that are co-equal and check, you know, each other. I mean, the kind of government our Constitution promised us, that our framers set up, as well as the framers of our individual state constitutions, it has been embattled now for a century, and it's been, you know, really counteracted and limited and strangled by a lot of legal doctrines, court judgments, and political changes that have especially happened over the last century. And so Americans, you know, some of us are aware of, you know, just changes to the Constitution, the courts overriding it, and all the different breakings of norms that have happened, but we don't apply that often to our everyday life. So we will still assume that we can call our legislator, we can go to a school board meeting, you know, and make all these traditional ways of making our voice heard, you know, that really ought to work, and that is the way the system was originally designed. But many of those avenues for basically translating the consent of the governed into actual government have been, you know, neutered and blocked, so that, you know, even when parents do things like run to the school board, stampede them, go to their state legislature, go to their state boards of education, there are many more powerful interests that are standing in the way and making it so that there, many of the people who are supposed to represent them don't listen to the people at all.
What lessons should we learn from attempts to deal with Common Core in the classroom? What should we know about those attempts?
Right. So as I've been, you know, kind of watching this critical race theory discussion break out, I've been having some deja vu because, as a lot of your longtime listeners will know, I spent years as an education reporter and wrote a book based on that reporting about the whole Common Core phenomenon. And so what I saw then was really what has informed my conclusion I just said to you, is that what happened is you had waves upon waves of people doing the same thing then that they are doing now. They went to their school boards, they went to their state boards of education, they went to their state lawmakers, to their, you know, education committees and so forth. They showed up with hundreds and hundreds of people. They spent months protesting, calling lawmakers, holding rallies, sending letters, holding up signs, all of those pretty, you know, things. And it was very rare that after all of that effort, they could even get some kind of law limiting or curtailing Common Core. And even there were only two instances where states allegedly, you know, said that they had gotten rid of Common Core. But what really happened in those states, and I live in one of them, Indiana, was basically the State Board of Education fed Common Core through a thesaurus and put it right back into law. And then, you know, then the public was told, oh, we got rid of it. That's just a complete lie. So, I mean, so in watching all that happen and then learning about the various ways that unelected people really control a lot of what actually happens in this country, I've learned a lot about how American government, how dysfunctional it is, why Americans feel so fed up and like they can't get anything down, why they tune out and really go to despair. I mean, there are some legitimate reasons for that. And, you know, some of that really fed, for example, the election of Donald Trump in 2016 that, you know, shocked everybody out of their ever-loving minds. And that phenomenon has not gone away, and neither have, you know, the problems, the clogs in our system of governance that have led to that disconnect. They are still present, and therefore we can conclude, you know, since the things that are blocking the people's ability to run their own lives and for the representatives to listen to them, those have really not been cleared away hardly at all. And so, you know, we can expect based on that reality that some people will succeed. You know, you'll see maybe some school boards at least temporarily flip. But I would wager, you know, based on historical experience and how the deck is stacked against parents, that many of the people who are now, you know, spending all of these hours trying to really, like you said in the introduction, prevent state-sponsored racism from being pushed in their public schools, many of these people will fail to accomplish that, even though they'll spend lots of their time, lots of their money, and many years of their children's education in schools that had failed them to such a level that they didn't stop racism from being taught to small kids.
Why isn't replacing the school board enough?
Well, you know, to be honest, I mean, again, as I learned from reporting on Common Core, school boards do not control curriculum. I mean, they can take the reins of that, but, you know, the typical school board is more infrastructure sorts of things like salary negotiation with the local union. So I spent, you know, a little while actually, you know, reporting on local school district. You know, their meetings are, they do, you know, awards. They, you know, have public recognition for, you know, public service for kids who, you know, maybe got athletic trophies or whatever. And, you know, they basically pass the budget. You know, they're just kind of a high level, generally a rubber stamp for whatever the superintendent, you know, wants to be done. Of course, the superintendent is not typically an elected position. So first of all, you know, school boards are really not set up to get into what's happening on the daily life in classrooms. They have to necessarily delegate that to schools and teachers in the classroom. And so even if they have the courage to stand against this, and there are powerful forces against it. So for example, the National Education Association, one of the nation's top two teachers organizations, I'm pretty sure it was the NEA. I'm sorry, that's the biggest one. I'm just sitting here because I've also seen statements from the head of the other large union. But anyway, they have publicly announced they're putting millions of dollars in lawyers behind, you know, any parents who try to get rid of this in their schools. They're going to face an army of millions of dollars funded lawyers. You know, so a school board, and I've seen this happen, you know, with many other issues, a local school board, and I've seen this happen at state school boards. They're going to look at that and say, well, you know, practically speaking, why would I, you know, I'd have to spend taxpayer dollars to pay the legal defense against these, basically these wolves, these jackals. And so, and what's my likelihood of winning in court? Actually, I think, you know, there is better likelihood of winning in court, but court battles take years to work out anyway. So they'll do a cost benefit analysis, and very often they just fold. They say, you know, we'd have to pay millions of dollars for lawyers. Our school district doesn't have that, or we're not willing to risk it. I'm just going to, you know, shut up and let these people yell at me and take it and just vote against them because, you know, these people, they're not going to pay $5 million to fight the lawyers that are, you know, threatening our school district with a lawsuit. And so that's one example of how, again, the people are neutered in their ability to demand that their local school actually do things that the local people want. You know, the NEA is a national organization, has nothing to do, you know, with local taxpayer, you know, and just by threatening a lawsuit, it can control the public funds that are provided by, you know, not the NEA. So it's kind of outrageous, but that's how things work in this country.
At the state and national level, how are Democratic politicians attempting, in some cases, to distance themselves from critical race theory?
Oh, this has been really interesting. So it really proves that the parent outrage on this has hit a mark that it's really indefensible, the critical race theory. Like, there's just really no way, you know, to be able to stand up and say, I support teaching an 8-year-old that because he's born with the quote unquote wrong skin color, you know, he should be punished and feel bad about himself. I mean, that's literally what this doctrine is. So the Biden administration, as well as Democrat politicians and that corporate media, leftist media, have taken a number of attempts to kind of pretend like, you know, this isn't, they do the whole Jedi mind trick of, you know, the racism you're seeing in schools is not actually racism, or we don't actually, you know, la, la, la. And part of the reason they do that is, I mean, quite honestly, that leftist philosophy drives all of this. They believe that people's value is determined by their group identity. That's basic tenet of identity politics, which is where all the energy on the Democrat Party is right now. It's where they get their donations, it's where they get their activists. It's where they get, you know, their court victories, such as, you know, for example, Obergefell, all based on that kind of ideology. So they can't back away from it in reality. But since it's politically toxic, you know, they have to back away from it rhetorically. So they have to kind of do this one-step dance. And that's exactly what we've seen them doing. So, for example, the Biden administration has said, they basically have just done the same thing as with Common Core. Oh, we don't support critical race theory. We support equity. To them, equity means the same thing as critical race theory. Equity doesn't mean actual equal treatment before the law. It means equity means giving more resources to the people the government claims needs more resources. That's not equity, you know. So they're just basically shifting their rhetoric in an attempt to hide the horrible reality that people are waking up to on this issue.
We have learned over the last year or so that the teachers' unions are extraordinarily powerful on different political fronts. What can be done about the teachers' union? You mentioned them a few minutes ago when it comes to CRT.
Well, we first of all have to realize that teachers' unions are not some independent entity. They use teachers basically as their faces on their placards to hide the fact that they're essentially a lobbying arm of the Democratic Party. They are the number one or number two, depending on the election cycle you look at, going back 50 years, number one, number two bundler of funds for the Democratic Party. So this is really a nakedly political organization. And a lot of their funds come, again, coerced from taxpayers, because some states force teachers, you know, in order to be employed as a teacher, you have to basically give a cut through to a union. So taxpayers are effectively backhandedly subsidizing these unions that turn around and then use taxpayer dollars to fight taxpayer representation at local school boards to say, you will take your money by force through teachers in quote unquote union dues, and then we'll use your own money to, you know, mount a legal defense against what you say you want in your local school districts. It's a political racket. And that's been known to be the case for decades. And I don't, you know, and we've, you know, I've seen that, as you kind of alluded to, over the pandemic. Literally, teachers' unions, it was uncovered, were writing the regulations for school, quote-unquote, reopenings for the Biden administration. And, of course, it's in their best interest to, you know, have teachers not working as long as possible, pretending that COVID's the reason, while still continuing to get fully paid to be at home. So, again, complete racket. They should have no credibility in the public square and just be, you know, known for the charlatans that they are, who, you know, again, force money out of taxpayers' pockets, out of teachers' pockets, and into just rabid and open, you know, advocacy for the farthest left policies of the Democrat Party.
How should we make critical race theory an election issue?
Well, it already is an election issue. The fact that Democrats are having to back away from this and kind of pretend, you know, what you're seeing shows that, you know, their internal polling is terrible on this. So, you know, while Democrats are absolutely willing to ignore what Americans want, they can't do that as open, you know, with too many people finding out about it. So they kind of have to, you know, play this dance of political covering their tracks all the time. So it has been made an election issue. I mean, I guess the real question is what exactly is the effective plan, you know, that any candidate who says they oppose it, What is he or she going to do about it, right? You can't just say, you know, all of us are sick of politicians who say, oh, I support A, B, and C, and then they get into office and they do nothing, you know, or they just do rhetorical posturing but no effective policy making to follow through on that promise to voters. So that's really what I'm looking at when I'm looking at candidates who are talking about this issue. There's, you know, for example, one of the bellwethers in elections is the Virginia governor's race, which is in an off year right after, you know, presidential election. So it's often seen in as a bellwether. And so the Republican candidate in that race has made this one of his issues. He's otherwise kind of a lackluster guy, but he has that going for him. And it has been, you know, something he's talking about. But I would like to see from these people, okay, you know, name the positions that you're going to cancel, fire, defund, name the lawsuits, you know, the taxpayer resources you're going to dedicate to protecting parents, to protecting kids from this. You know, I want to see all those kinds of specifics, because without them, it's just empty rhetoric.
What is an anti-racism choice scholarship?
Well, that's something that I suggested in one of the articles we're talking about. So, you know, what I suggested one of the things that, you know, conservatives as a movement should do if they were actually serious about opposing critical race theory. And that would be something that, for example, a Republican political or any, I don't care what party they are, Democrats, you know, if they weren't so beholden to unions, I think some of them would be more malleable on this. So if a political candidate could say, I support the idea of a, you know, a critical race theory freedom scholarship, for example. So any child whose school district is teaching racially divisive things using taxpayer dollars, that child, you know, is now gets that money that was sent to the, from the state to that public school, can take it to any school, you know, that he or she wants, or use it for homeschooling or private tutoring or whatever the case. So we have, you know, many, many states around the country have all kinds of different school choice options, and some of them are dedicated for specific things. So some of them are specific scholarships for special needs kids, for example. Some are specific for poor kids, for example. And so this would just be another way of expanding that sort of, you know, way to help retrieve kids from these school districts that, you know, many times, you know, families don't have, some families do, but some families don't have the resources to move out of a school district that, you know, they can't influence, that's locked into this extremist ideology. And so that kind of a scholarship proposal would be one way to make good on the promise of, we actually, you know, would claim that, oh, I as a politician want to do something about this. Well, there's something to do.
Finally, who is Chris Rufo, and how is Chris showing ways to expose critical race theory in the classroom?
So Chris Rufo is just this kind of independent journalist. He's a fellow, I believe, at what the Discovery Institute. So it's just one of those basic conservative think tanks. And so he's been, you know, for years kind of journalist, documentarian. So he's done previous work on, for example, the homelessness crisis, you know, that I've seen, poverty in America. And so he had a whistleblower. He kind of became, by accident, the national lead on this subject, by having a whistleblower send to him some, I believe, training documents. The federal government was in one of its quote-unquote, you know, diversity and inclusion workforce trainings teaching this open racism, a critical race theory. So he reported that. He got it, you know, confirmed, and then broke the story on that. So then more people started sending them, oh, my goodness, this is happening over here. This is happening over here. So he just started verifying and reporting about what people were seeing and sending to him. And as a result of that work, he was invited on the Tucker Carlson show on Fox News, and he happened to just, you know, by his own account, he says he happened to, you know, at the time Donald Trump was the president. And so he happened to, on that TV show, you know, I say, I call on the president to end this, you know, it's happening at the federal government. He has the power to stop it within federal agencies. And, you know, within short order, the White House called him, had him come over, and they drafted an executive order that President Biden has went on to reverse, but it had banned for a time the teaching of this racism using federal resources and federal agencies and so forth. So he's become known as, he's almost a one-man army on this issue, and he's been doing amazing work simply because he's actually reporting, you know, using techniques journalists, you know, ought to be using, you know, just and reflecting the concerns of people. But so many journalists are more interested in pushing, you know, ideological leftist narratives. And obviously this puts the left in a very bad light.
Joy Pullman is managing editor of The Federalist. She's author of the book, The Education Invasion. And you'll find a link to her columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Joy, thank you.
Thank you.
The speaking lineup for the 2021 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference consisted of Molly and Mark Hemingway, Dr. Robert George, Jack Phillips, Pastor Brian Wolfmiller, Dr. Larry Rast, and Pastor Will Whedon. And you can watch a video recording of this year's conference. We'll send you a link to an on-demand video stream for a contribution of $300 to Issues Etc. Learn more at issuesetc.org or give us a call, 618-223-8385. Wednesday on Issues Etc., we'll get Pastor David Peterson's reaction to a New York Times column, What We Lose When We Live Stream Church, and we'll discuss What I Wish My Non-Lutheran Family Knew About Suffering with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller, and its media coverage of religion with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the Divine Service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.